This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. Today, we welcome back Seamus Egan.
Thank you.
This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the program Seamus Egan. How you doing?
I'm good, John. Thanks for having me. Hey, great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you back in the studio again. And I think it's been a while since we did an interview in the studio, but
yeah,
we've done a number of them over the years. And I'm going to, off the top of my head, think 5-6 over 20 years.
That would be a pretty safe bet.
Yeah,
I think
that's close to. Yeah, I think it is, because I think that when you first were coming out here, I think it was around 2000.
Yeah,
coming out here for our listening audience to Montana,
yes.
I should say.
Yes.
And so, great to have you here in the studio. SeamusEganProject.com is the name of Seamus's website. Early Bright is the most recent recording, and it is the first recording of the Seamus Egan Project,
yes,
correct?
Yeah. Correct.
Okay. And a lot of our listeners, of course, are going to be very familiar with Seamus and his work with the band Solus. As I've mentioned, he's been on Musician Spotlight a number of times, multi-instrumentalist and composer and songwriter, also a film composer. I was thinking about this the other day, the Brothers McMullen. I dug that movie before I think I realized that you guys were on the soundtrack.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Great stuff there. Several solo recordings also before forming Solus, more so than I had originally thought.
More solo?
Yeah. There's quite a few.
There's three before the first Solus album.
Yeah, very good. Well, let's maybe start with having you explain what's happened since we caught up last with you, which was the 20th anniversary tour of Solus. We turned that into a Musician Spotlight Monday special. It was actually a lot of fun. We got to talk with you, with Winifred, with Maura, and with Karen Casey.
Yeah.
All of them put a real nice special together. This was around the time that you tried to cut your finger off in order to get out of the interview for Musician Spotlight. And so we had to redo the whole thing down in Bozeman in the basement of Music Villa.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that worked out. It worked out fine.
I kept my finger.
You kept your finger.
At the end of the day, one lets me go near knives anymore. My food is cut for me by pleasant, helpful people.
Yeah. So that's where we left off. Was, you know, the 20-year anniversary of Solus. So this was now, what, 3 or 4 years ago now, I think.
Yeah, so that would have been in 2016,
I
guess.
Too,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so, the album came out. And then, the band toured that album for about a year, a little over a year. And then we sort of wrapped that up at the beginning of 2017. And the band's been on a break since. We decided that was... coming up on the 20th, we were like, we'd been talking about the idea of hitting pause for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like a good sort of benchmark if you were going to hit pause, kind of a nice round number of 20 years. And it's been going through, the getting used to not being on the road all the time, because Solus was definitely, we were tearing up the highways and byways for a number of years. So
certainly, and I'm trying to remember when we last spoke. For some reason, I'm thinking you were already kind of starting to think ahead to this Seamus Egan project. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been threatening to do an album for, maybe probably like 15 years, and I didn't. It was just. It never got up the list of high enough on the to-do list for me to take it seriously. Once I knew that the band was going to, slow down, it became something that was, that jumped up to the top of the list because I had time and I'd been writing a lot of stuff. Some of the stuff obviously ended up with Solus, but I had a bit of a drawer full of ideas and, some new ideas on the way. And I just, it seemed like a good time to, try and air them out.
Well, that was one of the things I was going to get to, was the writing of the material and whether or not you wrote specifically for the Seamus Egan Project versus Solus, or if it was a matter of you wrote stuff and then thought, okay, well, this is going to be good for the band and this is going to be ready. This is going to be, more appropriate for the next project that I'm putting together.
I mean, certainly when Solus was more in the forefront, I would be thinking about that, and then stuff that would just kind of happen, I wouldn't necessarily go, oh, that's for a specific thing. I would just sort of tuck it away and go, okay, there might be a time when, you know, that might be good for something, whether it might maybe might be good for, you know, something in a documentary or who knows, you know. So for the new album, I knew that there was stuff like on the immediate, sort of in the immediate past that was still kind of in the short, my short-term memory that I, so I went back to that pretty easily. And then, like, I didn't want to sort of impose anything on it. I just wanted it to sort of see how it was developing. And I think it was probably a subconscious at the beginning sort of reaction to like having the sort of the confines of a band where you're, you know, you're very aware of what you're writing for and what the elements of it will be. For this, I just wanted it to see, you know, just make it and then see if it developed into a through line kind of started to appear.
Seamus Egan joining us here on Musicians Spotlight. I want to ask you if you wrote, if you write music programmatically. In other words, you know, in full disclosure, I've just seen you as we're recording this the night before at a house concert, and I want to talk a little bit more about that setting. But you're really good at telling stories about the songs and where they're, you know, where they come from. And of course, as was the case last night, hearing you play, it was all instrumental music. So those stories come in handy, I think, for the average listener to kind of hear a little more of the setting and so forth. And a lot of them have very specific stories in terms of where the titles came from and so forth. But I guess what I'm trying to get to is, do you write programmatically? And for our listeners' sake, when I say programmatically, I mean like with an idea other than just the notes themselves. You have a song you wrote about your niece, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, does the idea come to you, okay, I'm going to write a song for my niece, or does the song come out and you're like, I think I'll give that one to my niece?
I think it's probably more so the latter. I think someone had asked me if the sources of inspiration for something, and you know, if you're in a beautiful location, does that you go, mm-hmm. oh, okay, I must run home and make this in honor of that beautiful lake or something, you know,
moonrise.
Yeah. and I'd never really thought about it, which, you know, clearly meant that's, I don't do that. You know, it never had to, but I think what happens with me is that I'll sort of accumulate these things and then they start to stick together in some sort of way. And then it's more, I think, that idea or that sentiment then starts to get expressed, you know, because, and this is not, I'm not saying this from having put a great deal of thought into this by any stretch, but like I'll go occasionally, like if I've got a long flight or, you know, whatever, and I'm traveling, I'll start to go through my voice memos on my phone, and I can kind of hear, like I can look at dates on the sound files, and I'll start to sort of realize, oh wow, a lot of these things have a particular sort of thread to them, whether it's sort of, you know, harmonically or just sort of the feeling of it, and then that feeling or whatever will stop, and then there's, you know, a bunch of other ones and with different dates, and it started to kind of make me think, that I was clearly feeling a certain thing in this window of time, and okay. here's the sort of proof of it, because if I played the, you know, not that I would play what these are for anyone, but you can kind of, I go, oh wow, that's interesting, you know, and I can hear the development of an idea, and like I might have 25 of these snippets, and eventually, and that those 25 will maybe become one thing. I can pick up on the development of it, and so like the earliest date on my phone for that idea. And then, you know, you can follow it through to the, and quite often I'm not aware of it while it's, you know, it's not like, oh, that was an idea, let me develop that. It's not that thought out. It just sort of happens. And then in retrospect, I can go back and say, oh, I can see now how this developed.
This is John Floridis. You're listening to Musicians Spotlight. I'm speaking today with Seamus Egan. Another song that was coming to my mind was the one about the whale.
Mm.
No, is that one on the, I'm trying to remember, is that on the...
That's on the album.
Okay, that's on the album. So let's talk about that a little bit. That was a fascinating... And I know, you made light of the story. It was kind of like a bittersweet sort, but kind of amusing story in some ways, too. I mean, but...
Yeah. I mean, the story is, I think, is there's something in there that I think that's incredibly human.
Mm-hmm.
You're out there. I mean, just a really short synopsis of what we're talking about. I'd come across the story of a whale that scientists had been following. That was, its transmitter was, something was wrong with it, and it was sending out its whale song at a frequency that other whales could not hear.
Hmm.
And there was just, so this poor whale is just floating around, swimming around the oceans, just calling out and getting nothing back.
Yeah,
and I think that at some point, I think everyone at some point in their life has had that feeling, I'm just shouting into the void,
mm-hmm.
So I think there's, that was what struck me.
Right. What frequency are we transmitting our communication?
Yeah.
And sometimes it can be maybe you hear it, but it's not quite resonating because it's not quite the frequency. You hear a sound, but it's not really resonating with the person.
And yeah, and then I suppose the hope is that you grow, you can kind of fine tune your frequencies and get it to the point where you can receive as well as I suppose transmit, not to get too far into it. But
so I guess the question is, Seamus, then how do you get that feeling and convey that in instrumental music?
The thing that I like about instrumental music particularly is that anyone can hear it and they bring themselves, the listener brings themselves to it. And that interaction isn't static.
Mm-hmm.
Because, we all listen to music and there are times where you could hear the same piece and it makes you feel something. Hear it again, down the road at another point in your life, it's a different thing again.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something that's really immediate, or maybe it's something now that's a memory. That's something that I love about instrumental music. And it also is the thing that makes me sometimes reluctant to go too much into the thing behind it.
Because, I see what you're saying, because you don't want to project your own.
Yeah, it's almost
thing
like
into
yeah,
listener,
it's almost
the
like
listener's experience.
I want the person to have their own their own connection to it.
Yeah.
So in the album, the format of the album, where you're just streaming it or whatever, you're just hearing it, which I like. In the context of the live show, there sometimes I think you have to, you have to kind of set it up a little bit and there's that. But, I think that it's still, I try, I suppose, to keep it open enough, because I don't want to sort of take that experience away from someone, that they can just make it their own. They don't have to hear me babbling on about, about, what made me write this. Mm-hmm. That's the thing I really love about instrumental music. It's like a blank, blank canvas.
Thank you. We'll be back with more Musicians Spotlight and our interview with Seamus Egan. Welcome back to Musicians Spotlight and our conversation with Seamus Egan. This is John Floridis. You're listening to Musicians Spotlight. I'm speaking today with Seamus Egan. Seamus, one of the things that we talked about before we started the interview was that in our past interviews, of course, we've been, you know, so focused on the band Solas and how the different players come together and so forth, and some great conversations. You know, one of the things you come across when you read Seamus Egan's bio all the time is the All Ireland contests and the early recognition that you got as a very young boy.
Yeah.
And so I want to touch on that a little bit. I don't think that we've ever really talked about, you know, what it was like in your household and where this comes from. I'm probably going to embarrass you by saying the word prodigy, but it's a word that comes up quite a bit in discussing your career and the early origins of that. And so I'm kind of interested in what kind of a musical environment was happening in your home, and where does that spring from?
Well, we lived in the west coast of Ireland. It was, you know, a rural community, and we grew up without television. Yeah, but, you know, there was six of us, four sisters and a brother, and, you know, we lived out in the country. My parents wanted us to learn, you know, with no plan. All right, you know, it was just sort of, you know, we're here, and, you know, you're going to learn a little bit about your culture, your heritage. And that was the idea behind it. And they would send us off down to the music, for music lessons once a week to the town hall.
And how early did this start for you?
I was about six.
Okay.
Seven, something like that. Yeah.
And for American, with listeners outside of Ireland, how normal is that in Irish culture where you were growing up?
I guess it was normal enough. The music teacher, I mean, his name was Martin Donoghue, and he would just travel around to different, he'd have a different town, mm-hmm. I guess, you know, each day of the week. I remember it being, you know, not something that not every kid in town did.
Okay.
There wasn't a ton of us doing it. You know, I remember being grateful that it was a tin whistle that I could hide in my pocket and that other kids wouldn't see me going.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah. It was that sort of, like, it wasn't, yeah. And, like, I remember then when I started learning banjo, I was like, oh, that's going to be harder to hide. Because it was like it was about a mile walk from our house into the town.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, so the whistle was fine. I could just put that in.
Mm-hmm.
The guy in the banjo was like, oh my goodness. So yeah, it was, you know, it was something that you didn't particularly advertise.
No, why is that? Like, that's very curious to me. Why would you not advertise that?
I don't know. It was something, well, I mean, I think you're a kid. You don't want to particularly do, or at least for me, didn't want to do anything that would make you stand out a little bit.
I see.
And
okay.
Also, like, we were sort of, like, we'd moved over. Like, I was born in America, you know, and my family moved back, you know, to where my father was from. And so we were sort of the Yanks. So you're already sort of kind of a bit on the outside.
I'd forgotten the order there. I was thinking you were born in Ireland and then came back to Philly.
No, I was born just outside of Philadelphia, and then the family moved back.
Okay, all right.
So there was part of that, you know, that you were already, you know, you were different to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And then now, you know, I'm strolling up the road with a banjo. It's like, no, thank you. So yeah, so that's, you know, that you kind of keep that, you know, it was a priority for me to keep that, as quiet as I could.
Huh.
But that's how it started. I mean, we just went down once a week for the lessons. My parents didn't play, but they had a tremendous love for music, and there was always music on in the house. And then they brought us around to, you know, to sessions, to, you know, to the, you know, the music contests, the competitions. Mm-hmm. But they were always exposing us to it. And if any one of us who showed any sort of interest in a particular instrument, they would somehow, I don't know how they managed to do this with so many kids, that they would, that instrument would sort of, it would find its way into our hands. So that was an incredible advantage. You know, there was to you know, to be able to go, okay, you know, I remember hearing the banjo on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Maloney was playing the banjo. And I was fascinated by the sound of it, and I wanted to learn how to play. I wanted that sound, you know, that I was hearing coming out of the speakers.
Yeah.
And one day there was a banjo in the house.
Thank you. Seamus Egan joining us here on Musicians Spotlight. Seamus, you've always seen your work akin to jazz and classical in that it can unite people outside of just the experience people have with Irish, quote unquote, Irish music. Even when you started the band, it was not supposed to be strictly a traditional band. Mm. You've always kind of pushed on those boundaries of a bigger picture of where music that starts in Ireland, where can that go?
I love the idea of something small and personal going out, and that it has that. And it can hit a lot of people in a way that can be profound. That it doesn't have to have a set of rules attached to it. And I mean, I think Irish music is really it's inviting, and it's structurally strong.
Mm-hmm.
So it can withstand all these, outside influences. It kind of absorbs it and then spits out another version, but it's still, you hear that the original sort of lifeblood still kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably what I've been doing. Obviously my background is Irish music, and that's what I learned, but I've kind of absorbed all these other influences and interests that come through. And I think that just the idea of, you play Irish music, or you play bluegrass, or you play whatever, classical, mm-hmm. name it, that, that's not the totality of what it is that you do, or what you're able to express. That might be the language that it comes out but you're still processing what you're taking in from around you, and I think I think that's for Irish music particularly. I think it's one of the reasons that it, as a sort of a traditional music, as an ethnic music, that it has this sort of longevity.
Mm-hmm.
And that it resonates across borders and language.
Mm-hmm.
Its ability to sort of change. And it stays present somehow, and I think that's what we think of as traditional now in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different than what it was, say, in 1950 or in 1900 or 18. Mm-hmm. it shifts, and I think that's kind of kept it out of the museum.
Seamus Egan joining us here on Musicians Spotlight. Seamus, another thing I wanted to talk to you about was, of course, your connection to Butte. Now, we've gone over, our listeners have probably heard us talk about this in past Musician Spotlights, but let's just, in case they haven't, let's just touch a little bit on that, on Shamrock City, the project that had to do with you reconnecting with a family member that moved to Butte, America, as we call it here in Montana, Butte, America. you know, that journey has continued. It culminated in that project, that recording project, Shamrock City, and all the things that went around with that. But that's an ongoing thing for you. So maybe just give a quick synopsis of what we're talking about,
right.
and then kind of let's check in on that journey and how that's progressing for you, because it's an ongoing thing. As we sit here doing this interview, you're in a matter of minutes going to be heading back down in that direction and checking in, and it's not a story that's necessarily over for you.
No, this, just a quick background of the story is a great uncle had of mine came from Ireland, the west coast of Ireland, came to America, landed in Philadelphia, stayed there for a couple of years, and then moved on west and ended up in Butte, which certainly was a destination for lots of Irish amongst, you know. There was a destination for people from all over the world at that time. And he came to Butte in 1913, but he died in shortly thereafter in 1916. Mm-hmm. He was beaten to death by the police there. And, you know, so that was the story, you know, that sort of brought Butte to my, into my world. And, I remember hearing the story as a kid, and Butte was just a place that it didn't really exist. it was part
mythical.
Of a story. Yeah, it really was. As luck would have it, we got asked to go to Butte, and that really started the whole journey. And, we made an album about Butte and my family, and I think you work on these things, and, if you're lucky, you have some really nice unintended consequences, things you could never plan on. And part of that is really being sort of taken into the Butte family. It sort of feels very home-like to me now. Mm. It's a remarkable place. Yeah, it's just being there. It feels like, I kind of feel like okay here.
Mm, that's
you know.
And so it continues to serve you.
In ways that I wouldn't,
right.
Never plan, you couldn't have planned on.
Yeah.
It's...
just finding the story would have been nice enough.
Yeah.
But instead you get, in addition to a story and an album, you get this whole other thing that really gets to you on a deep level.
Yeah.
It's James Conway, right?
Well, it was Michael Conway.
Michael
Conway,
I beg your pardon. Michael
but that
Conway.
Was another brother. I mean, it was...
oh, James was another one? Oh, that's right, because there was like...
There was a lot.
A dozen.
Yeah, that was a lot.
I always like to bring his name into these conversations, because it seems important, because that's so important to you and your journey. I was like to kind of like call that energy into mm-hmm. the conversation.
Yeah.
But my next question was, what would you say Americans in general can learn from his experience and your experience in discovering his life's journey?
I mean, the one...
You don't have to be an Irish person or a person of Irish background. This is an American story as well.
It's a very American story. I mean, maybe it's the American story. If you're not, a Native American, someone somewhere in your past made that journey mm-hmm. to here. My story of, Michael Conway and my family and I mean, that's just, it's a reminder that we're a country of immigrants. It's the makeup of this country for all its good and all its bad. And now in 2020, all the millions of people who are sort of just out there, just forced out of their homes, hopefully will land someplace that this new story begins. It's unfortunate that we kind of, that idea and that feeling seems to be falling and fading into memory, and that's not going to lead us to a good place. The story of Michael Conway in Butte is just, it's just a small reminder. Take anyone's story, and there's something of value in that. And I think it's hugely important that as a country, we don't forget that. Thank you.
How about outside of music? Anything inspiring you particularly right now?
I don't know.
Who's the boxer right now? That's Tyson Fury.
Oh, Tyson Fury. Yeah. It's funny. Like, I used to be like mad about sports. I don't know what it is. I've become less interested in sports. But I know the name, and mm-hmm. I know that he had a big win.
He's an enormous man.
Yeah.
6'9", 300 pounds.
I wouldn't fancy getting hit by him.
No, I would not fancy that either.
No. I think I would just crumble into just a million pieces.
He's the guy you'd want to have as your friend growing up when you have the tin whistle that you have to hide in your pocket.
He would do well in Butte.
Yeah, I hope
he'd be okay.
Would do well in Butte. So beyond boxing,
My mom loves boxing.
Okay.
And she came into it late in life. My mom's just turned 80, 85 or 86.
Okay.
And she started going to Madison Square Garden.
For the fights.
At 80. Yeah, I know.
Wow.
And my dad, in his 70s, started getting tattoos. So...
These are the things of the Egan family that many folks don't know.
There you go. There's something. But yeah, it was my tattooed dad and my fight-loving mom.
That's great.
Hanging out in New York at Madison Square Garden.
SeamusEganProject.com is the name of Seamus's website. Early Bright is the name of the recording, and that came out within the last year?
Just in January.
In January?
This past January.
Wow, yeah. So there we go. Hot off the presses.
Exactly.
It's been a pleasure talking shop with you again, Seamus. I'm sure it won't be the last time.
I hope not.
We get together. But thanks so much for being a guest on Musician Spotlight.
Thank you.
This is John Floridis. You've been listening to Musicians Spotlight. Our guest today has been Seamus Egan. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so through the Montana Public Radio website, mtpr.org, as well as through our own website, musicianspotlight.org. You can also find us online on Facebook and on Twitter. Our program is available as a podcast from those websites as well as through iTunes. This interview was engineered by Cole Grant. Musicians Spotlight is a production of Montana Public Radio.